Chapter 9. Plans.
You had these illuminators brought to Amador?
Many would have flinched to hear such a cold tone from Pedro Niall, but not the man standing on the inlaid golden sunburst before Niall's plain high-backed chair. He exuded confidence and competence. Niall continued,
"There is a reason I have 2,000 of the children guarding the border with Terraban, Omerna. Terraban is quarantined. No one is allowed across the border. Not a sparrow would cross if I had my way."
Omerna was the picture of what an officer of the Children of the Light was supposed to be, tall and commanding, with a bold, fearless face, a strong chin, and waves of white at his temples. His dark eyes seemed more than capable of surveying the harshest battlefield undismayed, as indeed they had. At the moment they seemed to indicate deeply considered thought. The white and gold tabard of a Lord Captain, anointed of the light, suited him.
"My Lord Captain Commander, they wish to establish a chapter house here."
Even his voice, deep and mellifluous, fit the image.
"Illuminators travel everywhere. It should be possible to slip agents among them easily. Agents welcomed into every town, every noble's manor, every ruler's palace."
Supposedly, Abdel Omerna was a relatively minor member of the Council of Anointed. In truth, he was the Children of the Light's spy master, after a manner of speaking.
"Think of it."
What Niall thought was that the Guild of Illuminators was Terrabanner to the last man and woman, and Terraban was infected with chaos and madness that he would not let loose in Amadicia. If cauterizing that infection had to wait, he could at least isolate it.
"They will be treated like anyone else who slips through, Omerna. Kept under guard, allowed to talk to no one, and escorted out of Amadicia without delay.
If I may insist, my Lord Captain Commander, their usefulness is worth the little gossip they might spread. They keep to themselves, and aside from their use for my agents, the prestige of having an Illuminator's chapter house in Amador would be considerable. The only chapter house now, the one in Kyrian, has been abandoned, and the one in Tanchico surely has been too."
"Prestige?"
Niall rubbed his left eye to soothe an involuntary flutter. Little point in getting angry with Omerna, but restraint took an effort. The morning heat cooked his temper over a slow fire.
"They do indeed keep to themselves, Omerna. They live with their own, travel with their own, and barely speak to anyone else. Do you mean to have these agents marry illuminators? They rarely marry outside their guild, and there is no way to become an illuminator except by birth."
"Ah, well, I am sure a way can be found."
Nothing could dent that facade of confidence and competence.
"It shall be done as I say, Omerna."
The man actually opened his mouth again, but Niall forestalled him irritably.
"As I say, Omerna. I'll hear no more on it. Now, what information do you have today? What useful information? That is your function, not providing fireworks for Iron."
Omerna hesitated, plainly wanting to make another plea for his precious illuminators, but in the end he said portentously,
"The reports of Dragonsworn in Altara are more than rumor, it seems, and perhaps in Murundi as well. The infestation is small, but it will grow. A strong move now could settle for them and the Aes Sedai in Saladar in one..."
"Do you dictate strategy for the children now? Gather information and leave its use to me. What else do you have for me?"
The man's response to being cut off was a calm bow of acquiescence. Omerna was very good at remaining calm. It was perhaps what he did best.
"I have good news. Matin Stepaneus is ready to join you. He hesitates to make a public announcement, but my people in Ilion report that he soon will. He is reported eager."
"That would be remarkably good," Niall said dryly.
Remarkable, certainly. Among the banners and pennants lining the cornices of the chamber, Matin Stepanaeus's three leopards, silver on black, hung next to a gold-fringed Ileana royal standard, nine bees worked in thread of gold on green silk. The Ileana king came out on top in the troubles, finally, at least to the point of forcing a treaty that affirmed the border between Amadicia and Altara, where it was at the beginning. But Niall doubted the man would ever forget that he had had the advantage of terrain and numbers at Soramain, and still been defeated and captured. If the Ileana companions had not covered the field for the rest of the army to escape Niall's trap, Altara would be a fief of the children today, and very likely Murundi and even Ileon. Worse, Matin Stepanaeus had a Tarvalan witch for an advisor, though he hid the fact and her. Niall sent emissaries because he dared not leave a path untried. But yes, Matin Stepanaeus joining him, willingly, would be remarkable indeed. Continue, and be brief. I have a busy day today, and I can read your written reports later. Despite those instructions, O'Myrna's rendition was long, delivered in a sonorous voice full of certainty. Althor had barely extended his control in Andor beyond Camelon. His lightning onslaught was clearly stalled at last, as O'Myrna carefully pointed out that he had predicted. There was little chance the Borderlands would join the children against the false dragon any time soon. Lords in Shinar, Arafel, and Kandor were taking advantage of the Blight's quiet to rebel, and the Queen of Saldaea had gone into seclusion in the country, in fear of the same, according to O'Myrna. His agents were at work, however, and the Borderlands rulers would be brought to heel as soon as these small rebellions were quashed. On the other hand, the rulers of Murundi, Altara, and Giladon were ready to fall into line, though making ambivalent noises at present to soothe the Tarvalan witches. Aleandra of Giladon knew her throne was shaky, knew she needed the children to avoid plummeting as abruptly as her predecessors, while both Tylan of Altara and Rodran of Murundi hoped that the children's weight would make them more than figureheads at last. Plainly the man considered those lands already as good as in Niall's coat pocket. Within Amadicia, the picture was even better, by O'Myrna's reckoning. Recruits flocked to the children's banners in greater numbers than for years. Strictly speaking, this was none of O'Myrna's concern, but he always larded his reports with any good news he could find. The prophet would not trouble the land much longer. At present his rabble squabbled over looting villages and manors in the north, and might well scatter back into Giladon at the next push by Aelron soldiers. Little room remained in the jails because Dark Friends and Tarvalan spies were being arrested faster than they could be hanged. The search for Tarvalan witches had found only two so far, but over 100 women had been put to the question, an indication of how vigilant the patrols were. And fewer refugees from Tereban were being apprehended, proof the quarantine was becoming more effective. Those caught were being thrown back into Tereban as fast as they could be taken back to the border. He hurried past that last, unsurprising, given his stupidity with the Illuminators. Niall listened just enough to know where to nod. O'Myrna had been an adequate commander in the field, so long as someone told him what to do, but in his present position, his credulous stupidity was trying. He had reported Morgay's dead, her corpse seen and identified beyond doubt, up to the very day Niall brought him face to face with her. He had ridiculed rumors that the Stone of Tyr had fallen, and still denied that the mightiest fortress in the world could have been taken by any outside force. There had been treason, he insisted, a High Lord, who had betrayed the stone to Althor and Tarvalan. He maintained that the disaster at Falma and the troubles in Tereban and Arad-Daman were the work of Artur Hawkwing's armies come back across the Arath Ocean. He was convinced that Swan Sanche had not been deposed at all, that Althor was insane and dying, that Tarvalan had murdered King Galdrian to deliberately set off the civil war in Cairhien, and that these three facts were somehow tied into those ridiculous rumors, always from somewhere conveniently far away, of people bursting into flame or nightmares leaping out of thin air and slaughtering whole villages. He was not sure how exactly, but he was working on a grand theory he promised to deliver any day, a theory that supposedly would unravel all the witches' schemes and deliver Tarvalan into Niall's hands. That was the way with Omerna. He either invented convoluted reasons for what happened, or else seized on gossip in the streets and swallowed it whole. He spent a good deal of his time listening to gossip, in manor houses and in the streets. Not only had he been seen drinking in the taverns with Hunters for the Horn, it was an ill-kept secret that he had laid out huge sums for no fewer than 3 supposed horns of Alir. Each time he had carried the thing off to the country and puffed on it for days, till even he had to admit that no dead heroes out of legend were going to come riding back from the grave. Even so, the failures were unlikely to stop him from future purchases in dark alleys or the back rooms of taverns. The simple form of it was this. Where a spymaster should doubt his own face in the mirror, Omerna believed anything. Eventually the man ran down, and Niall said,
"I will give your reports due consideration, Omerna. You have done well."
How the fellow preened, smoothing his tabard.
"Leave me now. On your way out, send Balwar in. I have some letters to dictate."
"Of course, my lord captain commander."
"Ah!"
In the middle of his bow, Omerna frowned and fumbled in the pocket of his white undercoat, pulling out a tiny bone cylinder that he handed to Niall.
"This arrived at the Pigeon Cote this morning."
3 thin red stripes ran the length of the cylinder, meaning it was to be brought to Niall with the wax seals intact. And the man had almost forgotten it. Omerna waited, no doubt hoping for a hint of what the cylinder contained, but Niall waved him toward the door.
"Do not forget Balwar. If Matin Stepaneos might join me, I must write and see if I can add a little weight to his making the right decision."
Omerna had no choice but to make his bow anew and go. Even when the door closed behind the man, Niall only fingered the cylinder. These rare special messages seldom brought good news. Rising slowly, of late he sometimes felt age in his bones, he filled a plain silver goblet with punch, but then left it sitting on the table and flipped open a folder of scroll-worked leather lined with linen. It contained a single sheet of heavy paper, crumpled and partly torn, a street artist's drawing in colored chalks of 2 men fighting in clouds, one with a face made of fire, the other with dark reddish hair. Althor. All his plans to hinder the false dragon had gone awry, all his hopes to slow the man's tide of conquest, to divert him. Had he waited too long, let Althor grow too powerful? If so, there was only one way to deal with him quickly. The knife in the dark, the arrow from a rooftop. How long did he dare wait? Did he dare risk not waiting? Too much haste could spell disaster as surely as too long a delay.
"My lord sent for me."
Niall eyed the man who entered so silently. On the face of it, it hardly seemed possible that Balwar could move without a dry rustle announcing his presence. Everything about him was narrow and pinched. His brown coat hung from knobby shoulders, and his legs looked as if they might snap under his desiccated weight. He moved like a bird hopping from limb to limb.
"Do you believe the Horn of Valir will call dead heroes back to us, Balwar?"
"Perhaps, my lord," Balwar said, folding his hands fussily. "Perhaps not. I would not count on it myself."
Niall nodded.
"And do you think Matin Stepaneos will join me?"
"Again, perhaps. He will not want to finish dead or a puppet. His first and only concern is to hold on to the laurel crown, and the army gathering in Tyr must make him sweat for that."
Balwar smiled thinly, a bare compression of lips.
"He has spoken openly about accepting my lord's proposal, but on the other hand, I've just learned he has been communicating with the White Tower. Apparently he has agreed to something, though I don't yet know what."
The world knew that Abdel Omerna was the children's spymaster. Such a position should have been secret, of course, but stable boys and beggars pointed him out in the street, warily, lest the most dangerous man in Amadisia see them. The truth was that Omerna was a decoy, a fool who did not know himself that he was only a mask hiding the true master of spies in the Fortress of the Light. Seban Balwar, Niall's prim, dried-up little secretary with his disapproving mouth. A man no one would ever suspect or credit if he was named to them. Where Omerna believed everything, Balwar believed nothing, perhaps not even in Dark Friends or the Dark One. If Balwar did believe in anything, it was looking over men's shoulders, listening to their whispers, rooting out their secrets. Of course, he would have served any master as well as he did Niall, but that was all to the good. What Balwar learned was never tainted by what he knew had to be true or wanted to be true. Disbelieving everything, he always managed to root out truth.
"No more than I expected out of Ilion Balwar, but even he can be brought round."
He would have to be. It could not be too late.
"Is there any fresh word from the Borderlands?"
"Not yet, my lord. But Davram Bashir is in Camelod, with 30,000 light horse, my informants claim, but I think no more than half that. He would not weaken Saldea too far, however quiet the Blight, even if Tenobia commanded him to."
Niall grunted, the corner of his left eye trembling. He fingered the sketch lying in its folder. Supposedly it was a fair likeness of Althor. Bashir and Camelin. A good reason for Tenobia to be hiding in the country from his envoy. There was no good news from the Borderlands, whatever Omerna thought. The minor rebellions, Omerna reported, were minor, but not rebellions of the sort the man thought. Along the Blight border, men were arguing over whether Althor was another false dragon or the dragon reborn. Borderlanders being as they were, sometimes these arguments flared into small-scale battles. The fighting had begun in Shinar about the time the Stone of Tyr was falling, confirmation of the witch's involvement, if any, was needed. How it would all be settled was yet in doubt, according to Balwar. That Althor remained confined to Camelin was one of the few things Omerna had right. Yet why, with Bashir and Aiel and the witches? Not even Balwar had been able to answer that. Whatever the reason, the Light be praised for it. The Prophet's mobs had settled in to loot the north of Amadicia, true, but they were consolidating their hold, killing or putting to flight any who refused to declare for the Prophet of the Dragon. Aelron's soldiers had only stopped retreating because the accursed Prophet had stopped advancing. Aleandra and the others Omerna was certain would join him were in fact dithering, putting off his ambassadors with flimsy excuses and delays. He suspected that they knew no more how they would leap than he did. On the surface, everything seemed to be going Althor's way at the moment, except for whatever held him in Camelin. But Niall had always been at his most dangerous when he was outnumbered and with his back to the wall. If the rumors could be believed, Caradhyn was doing well in Altara and Mirandi, though not as quickly as Niall would have liked. Time was as much an enemy as Althor or the Tower. Yet even if Caradhyn was only doing well in the rumors, that should be enough. Perhaps it was time to extend the Dragon Sworn into Andor. Perhaps Ilion as well, though if the army gathering in Tyr was not enough to show Matin Stepanaeus the path, a few farms and villages raided would hardly make a difference. The size of that army horrified Niall. If it was half what Balwar reported, a quarter, it still horrified him. Nothing like it had been seen since Arthur Hawkwing's day. Rather than frighten men into joining Niall, an army like that might intimidate them into falling in behind the dragon banner. Could he have found a year, just half a year, he would have accounted it worth Althor's whole army of fools and villains and Aiel savages. All was not lost, of course. All was never lost as long as you were alive. Darabon and Arad-Doman were as useless to Althor and the witches as to him, two pits full of scorpions. Only a fool would put a hand in there until more of the scorpions killed one another off. If Saldea was lost, which he would not concede, Shinar and Darafel and Kandor still hung in the balance, and balances could be tipped. If Matt and Stepanaeus wanted to ride two horses at once, he'd always like to try that, he could yet be forced to choose the right one. Altara and Murindi would be prodded to the proper side, and Andor would drop into his hand whether or not he decided a touch of Carradine's whip was required. In Tyr, Bulwer's agents had convinced Tadosian and Istanda to join Darlan, turning a show of defiance into real rebellion, and the man was confident the same could be done in Kyrian and in Andor. Another month, two at the outside, and Eamon Valda would arrive from Tarvalen. Niall could have done without Valda, but then the great majority of the children's strength would be in one spot, ready to use where it could do the most good. Yes, he had a good deal on his side yet. Nothing had solidified, but everything coalesced. Time was all that was needed. Realizing he still held the bone cylinder, he cracked the wax seal with a thumbnail and carefully drew out the thin paper rolled up inside. Bulwer said nothing, but his mouth compressed again, not in a smile this time. Omerna he put up with, knowing the man a fool, much preferring to remain hidden himself, but he did not like Niall receiving reports that bypassed him, from men he did not know. A tiny, spidery scroll covered the slip in a cipher that few besides Niall knew, none of them in Amador. For him, reading it was as easy as reading his own hand. The sign at the bottom made him blink, and so did the contents. Varadin was, or had been, one of the best of his personal agents, a rug seller who did good service during the Troubles while peddling his wares through Altara, Murindi, and Ilion. What he earned there had set him up as a wealthy merchant in Tanchico, regularly supplying fine carpets and wines to the palaces of king and panarch, as well as to most of the nobles of their courts, and always leaving with his eyes and ears full. Niall had thought him long since dead in the upheaval there. This was the first word from him in a year. From what Varadin wrote, it would have been better if he truly had been a year dead. In the jerky hand of a man on the brink of madness, it was a wild, disjointed ramble about men riding strange beasts and flying creatures, Aes Sedai on leashes, and the Hylene. That meant forerunners in the old tongue, but there was not even an attempt to explain why Varadin was terrified of them, or who they were supposed to be. Plainly the man had taken a brain fever from watching his country disintegrate around him. Annoyed, Niall crumpled the paper and threw it aside.
First I must sit through Omerna's idiocy, and now this. What else do you have for me, Bulwer?
Bashir. Matters could become nasty with Bashir to General Althor's armies. The man had earned his reputation. A dagger in the shadows for him? Bulwer's eyes never left Niall's face by so much as a flicker, but Niall knew the tiny ball of paper on the floor would end up in the man's hands unless he burned it.
Four things that might be of interest, my lord. The least first. The rumors about meetings between the Ogier Steading are true. For Ogier, they seem to be showing some haste.
He did not say what the meetings were about, of course. Getting a human into an Ogier stump was as impossible as getting an Ogier to spy. Easier to have the sun rise at night.
Also, there are an unusual number of sea folk ships in the southern ports, not taking cargo, not sailing. What are they waiting for?
For a moment, Bulwer's mouth tightened as though drawstrings had been pulled shut.
I do not know yet, my lord.
Bulwer never liked admitting there were any human secrets he could not ferret out. Trying to learn more than the surface of what went on among the Atha on Mier was like trying to learn how the Guild of Illuminators made fireworks, an exercise in futility. At least the Ogier might eventually make known the decisions of their meetings.
Continue. The news of middling interest is peculiar, my lord. Althor has reliably been reported in Camelon, in Tyr, and in Kyrian. sometimes on the same day.
Reliably? Reliable madness? The witches probably have two or three men who look like Althor. Enough to fool anyone who doesn't know him. That would explain a good deal.
Perhaps, my lord. My informants are reliable.
Niles slapped the leather folder closed, hiding Althor's face.
And the news of greatest interest?
I have it from two sources in Altara, reliable sources, my lord, that the witches in Saladar claim the Red Aja encouraged Loghain to become a false dragon. All but created him, in fact. They have Loghain in Saladar, or a man they say is Loghain, and are showing him to nobles they bring there. I have no proof, but I suspect they are telling the same tale to any ruler they can reach.
Frowning, Niles studied the banners overhead. Those represented enemies from nearly every land. Not one had ever defeated him twice, and few once. The banners were all faded with age now, like him. Yet he was not too faded to see an end to what he had begun. Every banner taken in bloody battle, where you never really knew what was happening beyond sight of your own eyes, where certain victory and certain defeat could be equally ephemeral. The worst battle he had ever fought, armies blundering into one another in the night near Moisin during the Troubles, had been clear as a bright summer's day compared to the one he fought now. Could he have been wrong? Could the tower really be broken? A struggle of some sort between the Ajahs? Over what? Althor? If the witches were fighting among themselves, there would be many in the children ready to advocate Caradhan's solution. A strike to destroy Saladar, and as many of the witches as possible. Men who believed thinking of tomorrow was thinking ahead, but never considered next week or next month, let alone next year. Valda, for one. Perhaps it was just as well he had not reached Amador yet. For another, Radam Asinawa, the High Inquisitor of the Questioners. Valda always wanted to use an axe, even when a poniard was best for the task at hand. Asinawa just wanted every woman who had ever spent a night in the tower hanged as of yesterday, every book that mentioned Aes Sedai or the One Power burned, and the words themselves banned. Asinawa never had a thought beyond those goals, nor a care for costs. Niall had worked too hard, risked too much, to allow this to become a struggle between the children and the tower in the eyes of the world. In truth, it did not matter whether he was wrong. If he was, it still could be very much to his advantage, perhaps more than if he was right. With a little luck, he could shatter the White Tower past repairing, splinter the witches into shards easily ground to dust. Althor would surely falter then, while remaining enough of a threat to be used as a goad. And he could hold closely to the truth, fairly closely. Without taking his eyes from the banners, he said, "The split in the tower is real. The Black Aja rose up. The victors hold the tower, and the losers were driven out to lick their wounds in Saladar." He looked at Balwer and nearly smiled. One of the children would have been protesting that there was no Black Aja, or rather, that all the witches were dark friends. The newest recruit would have. Balwer merely looked at him, not at all as if he had just blasphemed against all the children stood for.
"The only decision to make is whether the Black Aja won or lost. I think they won. Most people will think of whoever holds the tower as the real Aes Sedai. Let them associate real Aes Sedai with Black Aja. Althor is a creature of the tower, a vassal of the Black Aja."
Lifting his wine cup from the table, he took a sip. It did not help the heat.
"Perhaps I can fit it in with why I haven't moved against Saladar yet."
Through his emissaries, he had been using the failure to move as proof of how dire he saw the threat from Althor. He was willing to let the witches congregate on Amadisia's doorstep rather than be diverted from the danger of the false dragon.
The women there, appalled after all these years at how pervasive the Black Arge is, repelled at last by the evil they've been immersed in.
His inventiveness ran out. They were all servants of the Dark One. What evil could repel them? But after a moment, Balwar took it up.
Perhaps they've decided to throw themselves on my lord's mercy, even ask my lord's protection. Losers in a rebellion, weaker than their enemies, fearing to be crushed. A man falling off a cliff to certain death will stretch out a hand even to his worst enemy. Perhaps...
Bulwer tapped bony fingers against his lips in thought.
Perhaps they are ready to repent their sins and renounce being Aes Sedai?
Niall stared at him. He suspected the Tarvalan witch's sins were among the things Balwar did not believe in.
"That is absurd," he said flatly. "It's the sort of thing I might expect from Omerna."
His secretary's face remained as prim as ever, but he began dry-washing his hands the way he did when he felt insulted.
"What my lord might expect to hear from him, but just the sort of thing that will be repeated where he does most of his listening, in the streets and where nobles gossip over wine. Absurdities are never laughed at there, only listened to. What is too absurd to believe is believed because it is too absurd to be a lie."
"How would you present it? I will start no rumor of the children dealing with the witches."
"It would only be a rumor, my lord."
Niall's gaze hardened, and Balwar spread his hands.
"As my lord wishes. Each retelling always adds embellishment, so a simple tale has the best chance of the core surviving. I suggest 4 rumors, my lord, not 1. The first, that the division in the tower was caused by a Black Arja uprising. The second, that the Black Arja won and control the tower. Third, the Aes Sedai and Salidar, repelled and horrified, are renouncing being Aes Sedai. And fourth, they have approached you, seeking mercy and protection. For most people, each will be a confirmation of the others."
Tugging on his lapels, Balwar gave a narrow, self-satisfied smile.
"Very good, Balwar. Let it be so."
Niall took a deeper drink of wine. The heat was making him feel his age. His bones seemed brittle. But he would last long enough to see the false dragon put down and the world united to face Tommen Gaten. Even if he did not live to lead in the last battle, the light would surely grant him that much.
"And I want Elaine Trakand and her brother Gawain found, Balwar, and brought to Amador. See to it. You may leave me now."
Instead of going, Balwar hesitated.
"My lord knows I never suggest any course of action."
"But you mean to suggest one now? What is it?"
"Press Morgaze, my lord.
More than a month has passed, and she still considers my lord's proposal. She..." "Enough, Balwar!"
Niall sighed. Sometimes he wished Balwar were not an Amadisian, but a Kyrenian, who had taken in the game of houses with his mother's milk.
"Morgaze is more committed to me every day, whatever she believes. I would like it better had she accepted immediately. I could have Andor raised against Ulthor today, with the thick leavening of children to stiffen it. But every day that she remains my guest ties her to me more tightly. Eventually she will discover she is allied to me because the world believes she is. Tangled so tightly she can never escape. And no one will ever be able to say, 'I coerced her, Balwar.' That is important.
It is always harder to abandon an alliance the world thinks you entered freely than one you can prove you were forced into. Reckless haste leads to ruin, Bulwer.
As my lord says.
Niall gestured a dismissal, and the man bowed his way out. Bulwer did not understand. Morgaze was a rugged opponent. Pressed too hard, she would turn and fight, whatever the odds. Yet pressed just hard enough, she would fight the enemy she thought she saw, and never see the trap building around her until it was too late. Time pressed down on him. All the years he had lived, all the months he desperately needed. But he would not let haste ruin his plans.
The stooping falcon struck the large duck in an explosion of feathers, and the two birds separated, the duck tumbling toward the ground. Banking sharply in the cloudless sky, the falcon swooped back onto her falling prey, clutched it in her talons. The weight of the duck burdened her, but she struggled back toward the people waiting below. Morgaze wondered whether she was like the falcon, too proud and too determined to realize when she had latched onto a prize too heavy for her wings to support. She tried to make her gloved hands loosen their grip on her reins. Her wide-brimmed white hat, with its long white plumes, provided a little protection from the unrelenting sun, but sweat beaded on her face. In a riding dress of green silk, embroidered in gold, she did not look a prisoner. Figures mounted and afoot filled the long pasture of dried brown grass, though they did not crowd it. A cluster of musicians in white-embroidered blue tabards with flutes and bitterns and tambours produced a light tune suitable for an afternoon over chilled wine. A dozen handlers in long, elaborately worked leather vests over billowing white shirts stroked hooded falcons perched on their gauntleted arms, or puffed short pipes and blew streams of blue smoke at their birds. Twice as many brightly liveried servants moved about with fruits and wine in golden goblets on golden trays, and a band of men clad in bright mail encircled the pasture just short of the largely bare-branched trees, all in aid of Morgaze and her retinue to ensure their hawking went safely. Well, that was the reason given, though the prophet's people were a good 200 miles north, and brigands seemed unlikely this close to Amador. And despite the women clustered around her on their mares and geldings, in bright silk riding dresses and wide-brimmed hats resplendent with colored plumes, their hair in the long ringlets currently in fashion in the Amadisian court, Morgaze's retinue in truth consisted of Basil Gill, awkward on his horse off to one side, with his jerkin of metal discs straining around his girth over the red silk coat she had procured him so he would not be outshone by the servants, and Piter Conal, even more awkward in a page's red and white coat, and displaying the nervousness he had shown since she added him to her party. The women were nobles from Aelron's court, volunteers to be Morgaze's ladies-in-waiting. Poor Master Gill fingered his sword and eyed the white-cloaked guards disconsolately. That was what they were, though as usual when escorting her out of the Fortress of Light, not wearing their white cloaks. And they were guards. If she tried to ride too far or remain out too long, their commander, a hard-eyed young man named Norowyn, who hated pretending to be other than a white cloak, would suggest that she return to Amador, because the heat was growing too great, or because of a sudden rumor of bandits in the area. There was no arguing with 50 armored men, not with any dignity. Norowyn had come within a hair of taking her reins from her the first time. That was the reason she never let Talanvor accompany her on these rides. That young fool might insist on her honor and rights if there were 100 men against him. He spent his spare hours practicing the sword as though he expected to carve a way to freedom for her. Startlingly, a sudden breeze brushed her face, and she realized that Lorraine had leaned from her saddle to fan her with a white lace fan. A slender young woman with dark eyes set slightly too close together, Lorraine wore a permanent simper. "It must be so gratifying for your majesty to learn that her son has joined the Children of the Light, and to have attained rank so quickly," "That should be no surprise," Altalin said, fanning her own plump face. "Her Majesty's son would, of course, rise quickly, as the sun in splendor does." She basked in the appreciative murmurs from some of the other women for her pitiful pun. Morgaze kept her face smooth with difficulty. Niall's news last evening during one of his surprise visits had come as a shock. Galada Whitecloak. At least he was safe, so Niall said. But unable to visit her, the duties of a child of the light kept him away. But assuredly he would be part of her escort when she returned to Andor at the head of an army of the children. No, Galad was no more safe than Elaine or Gawain. Perhaps less. The light send that Elaine was secure in the White Tower. The light send that Gawain was alive. Niall claimed not to know where he was, except that he was not in Tar Valon. Galad was a knife to her throat. Niall would never be so crude as to even suggest it, but one simple order from him could send Galad where he would surely die. The one protection he had was that Niall might think she did not care as much for him as for Elaine and Gawain. "I am pleased for him, if it is what he seeks," she told them in an indifferent tone. "But he is Taringale's son, not mine. Taringale was a marriage of state, you understand. Strange, but he's been dead so long I can hardly recall his face. Galad is free to do as he will. It is Gawain who will be first Prince of the Sword when Elaine follows me on the Lion Throne." She waved away a servant with a goblet on a tray. "Niall could at least have provided us with decent wine." A wave of anxious titters answered her. She'd had some success in drawing them closer to her, yet none could be easy about offending Pedro Niall. Not where it might get back to him. Morgaze took every opportunity to do so in their hearing. It convinced them of her bravery, important if she was to gain even partial allegiance. Perhaps more importantly, for her own mind at least, it helped maintain the illusion that she was not Niall's prisoner. "I hear that Randall Thor displays the Lion Throne like a trophy from the hunt." That was Miranda, a pretty woman with a heart-shaped face somewhat older than the others. The sister of the high seat of House Algoron, she was powerful in her own right, perhaps powerful enough to have resisted Aelron, but not Niall. The others reined their mounts aside for her to heel her bay gelding closer to Morgaze. There was no question of gaining any sort of allegiance or friendship from Miranda. "I have heard as much," Morgaze replied blithely. "The lion is a dangerous animal to hunt, and the Lion Throne more so, especially for a man. It always kills men who seek it." Miranda smiled. "I also hear he gives high places to men who can channel." That produced uneasy glances among the other women, and a worried buzz. One of the younger women, Marowyn, slight and little more than a girl, swayed in her high-cantled saddle as if she might faint. News of Althor's amnesty had spawned frightening tales. Rumors only, Morgaze fervently hoped. The light send it was all rumor. Men who could channel gathering in Camelin, carousing in the royal palace, terrorizing the city. "You hear a great deal," Morgaze said. "Do you spend all your time listening at cracked doors?" Miranda's smile deepened. She had been unable to resist pressure to become one of Morgaze's attendants, but she was powerful enough to show her displeasure without fear. She was like a thorn driven deep into the foot, impossible to dislodge, and giving a sharp jab at every step. "I have little time left from the pleasure of serving your Majesty to listen anywhere, but I do try to catch what news I can of Andor, so I may converse with your Majesty. I hear the false dragon consorts daily with Andorran nobles. Lady Aramilla and Lady Nan, Lord Jarin and Lord Lur. Others, friends of theirs." One of the falconers lifted a hooded, sleek, grey bird with black wings up to Morgaze. Silver bells on the falcon's jesses tinkled as she shifted on the handler's gauntlet. "Thank you. But I have had enough of hawking for today," Morgaze told him, then raised her voice. "Master Gil, gather the escort. I am returning to the city." Gil gave a start. He knew very well that all he was there for was to ride at her heels, but he began waving and shouting orders to the white cloaks as if he believed they would obey. For her part, Morgaze turned her black mare immediately. She did not take the animal faster than a walk, of course. Norwynn would have been on her like a flash if he saw a possibility she was considering escape. As it was, the cloakless white cloaks were galloping to form up their escort before the mare had gone 10 steps, and before she reached the edge of the meadow, Norwynn was at her side, a dozen men ahead and the rest close behind. The servants and musicians and falconers were left to gather themselves up and follow as quickly as they could. Gil and Piter took their places behind her, and then came the ladies-in-waiting. Miranda wore her smile like a badge of triumph now, though some of the others frowned in disapproval. Not too openly. Even if she had had to yield to Niall, the woman was a force to be reckoned with in Amadicia. But most of them did try to do their best at a task they did not want. For the greater part, they would likely have attended Morgaze willingly. It was residing inside the Fortress of the Light they did not like. Morgaze would have smiled herself if she could be sure Miranda would not see it. The only reason she had not insisted weeks ago that the woman be sent away was how free she was with her tongue. Miranda enjoyed pricking her with how far Andor had fallen from her grasp, but the names she chose were a balm to Morgaze. All men and women who had opposed her during the succession, all sycophants of Gabriel. She expected no less of them and no more. Had Miranda named others, the result would have been different. Lord Pellavar, or Abella, or Luan, Lady Aracella, or Elorian, or Aemlyn, others. They had never been part of Miranda's stabs, and they would have been if even a whisper from Andor had made her think of them. So long as Miranda did not mention them, there was at least hope that they had not knelt to Althor. They had supported Morgaze's first claim to the throne, and they might yet again, the light willing. Nearly leafless forest gave way to a road of hard-packed dirt, and they took it south toward Amador. Stretches of woods alternated with coppiced trees and fallow stone-fenced fields, with thatch-roofed stone houses and barns standing well back from the road. A good many people crowded the way, raising dust that made Morgaze tie a silk kerchief across her face, though they scrambled aside onto the verge at the first glimpse of such a large party of armed and armored men. Some even darted into the trees, or leaped fences and scurried across the fields. The white cloaks ignored them, and no farmers appeared to shake a fist or shout at the trespassers. Several of the farms had an abandoned look, with no chickens or animals in sight. Among the people on the road there was an ox-cart here, a man with a few sheep there, somewhere else a young woman herding a flock of geese. Plainly they were all local people. Some had a bundle shouldered or a fat scrip, but most were empty-handed, walking as if with no idea where they were going. The numbers of the latter sort had increased every time Morgaze had been allowed to leave Amador, no matter in which direction. Adjusting the kerchief over her nose, Morgaze eyed Norwynn sideways. He was about Talanvor's age and height, but there the resemblance ended. Red-faced under his burnished conical helmet and peeling from the sun, he had never been handsome. A lanky build and a thrusting nose made her think of a pickaxe. Every time she left the Fortress of the Light, he led her escort, and every time she tried to engage him in conversation. White cloak or not, every inch she could shift him from being her jailer was a victory. "Are these people refugees from the Prophet, Norwynn?" They could not all be. As many were heading north as south. "No," he said curtly, without even glancing at her. His eyes scanned the roadsides as if he expected a rescue to appear for her any moment. That, unfortunately, was the sort of response she had had so far, but she persevered. "Who are they, then? Not Taraboners, surely. You do a very good job of moving them on." She had seen a party of Taraboners, 50 or so men, women, and children, dirty and half-falling with weariness, being herded west like cattle by mounted white cloaks. Only the bitter knowledge that she could do absolutely nothing had enabled her to hold her tongue. "Amadicia is a rich land. Even this drought cannot have driven so many from their farms in just a few months. Norwin's face worked. No, he said finally. They are refugees from the false dragon. But how? He is hundreds of leagues from Amadicia. Again a struggle was plain on the man's sunburned face, either for words or against speaking. They believe he is the true dragon reborn, he said at last, sounding disgusted. They say he has broken all bonds according to the prophecies. Men forsake their lords, apprentices desert their masters, husbands abandon their families and wives their husbands. It is a plague carried on the wind, a wind that blows from the false dragon. Morghese's eyes fell on a young man and woman huddled in each other's arms, watching her party pass. Sweat streaked the dirt on their faces, and dust coated their plain clothes. They looked hungry, their cheeks sunken, their eyes too big. Could this be happening in Andor? Had Randall Thor done this to Andor, too? If he has, he will pay. The problem was making sure the cure was not worse than the disease. To deliver Andor even from this, and hand it to the White Cloaks. She tried to keep the conversation going, but having delivered himself of more words than he had ever before spoken to her at one time, Norwin retreated into monosyllables. It did not matter. If she could crack his reserve once, she could again. Twisting in her saddle, she tried to see the young man and woman, but they were hidden behind the White Cloak soldiers. That did not matter either. Those faces would reside in her memory, alongside her promise.